Welcome, everyone. I apologize. I have almost no voice thanks to our crazy weather and a sinus infection. So bear with me. I'll be really quick. I'm Lori Leroy, and I'm the Vice President of Communications for BioCrossroads, and we'd like to welcome you to our first Frameworks of 2016. It's great to see all of you. We see some new faces. I think a lot of healthcare providers today, which is a great addition to our general audience. First, I want to thank our printers, Miles Printing, for providing our signage and our programs today. We're very grateful for their sponsorship. And real quickly, before we dive into the bulk of the conversation today, I did want to do a little BioCrossroads plug this morning. You may have seen yesterday we came out with our annual statistics for the life sciences industry for Indiana. And I'm very pleased to say that we are holding our own. We are steady as a national leader. Two highlights I'd love to point out is that the life sciences industry in Indiana contributes $62 billion to the economy. So it's critically important that we continue to grow this industry. Another great point is that we have almost $10 billion in life sciences exports each year. And that's second in the country. So California is one, Indiana is two. And per capita, we blow California, of course, out of the water. So we're really proud of that fact as well. And actually, that's 29%, so almost a third of the all exports are life sciences exports. So that's really, really good news. We've stayed very strong on our employment numbers, number of companies, job and wages continue to go up. So it's a good story, and BioCrossroads and a lot of our partners are working very hard to make sure that we maintain and even grow that. And I think we've got lots of opportunities to do that with the Indiana Biosciences Research Institute, as well as plans for 16 Tech here in the next couple of years. So anyway, I just want to give a little plug to that. Our annual report came out yesterday as well, and we actually launched a new website. So check out biocrossroads.com, and you'll see all kinds of great information. So now what I want to do is talk about our presentation for today. It is one of the hotter topics that you're seeing in the news right now and in headlines, which is drug abuse and misuse. Indiana, unfortunately, is leading the nation in some of some not great categories right now. So pain management is very real and very important, and those advances in drug therapies such as opioids are necessary to improve patient outcomes. But what we'll talk about today is evaluating and mitigating the risk of prescribing opioids and how Indiana drug companies, healthcare providers, and the entire system are working together to ensure the benefits of pain management are outweighing the risk involved with abuse and misuse. So today we're going to hear from Dr. Joan Duvey. She's the Chief Medical Officer for the State of Indiana Department of Health, along with industry experts from AIT Laboratories and Community Health Network. So now I'd like to introduce Dr. Duvey. She is the Associate Dean for Public Health Practice and a Clinical Associate Professor in Health Policy and Management at the IU Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. And she also serves as the Chief Medical Officer at the Indiana Department of State of Health. She also co-chairs the State Prescription Drug Abuse Prevention Task Force and is a member of the Governor's Task Force on Drug Enforcement, Treatment, and Prevention. So, Dr. Duvey, thank you so much.
Good morning, and thank you to BioCrossroads for bringing us all together really today to talk about this real and actually growing problem in Indiana. And as Lori, I mean, that's really great news about BioCrossroads and the progress Indiana has made in this arena. I'm here to, unfortunately, give you some statistics that aren't so happy. Okay. And I can't see the slides, so forgive me if I start talking about the wrong slide. Just let me know. In 2012, The injury prevention epidemiologist at the State Department of Health actually flashed this slide during a presentation, which shows, if you look at that bottom bar, an over 500% increase in the rate of unintentional poisoning deaths here in the state of Indiana between 1999 and 2009. This was an unprecedented increase in poisoning deaths, and it mirrored what was going on nationally, largely due to an increase in prescription opioid prescribing and misuse. Rates of drug poisoning death in Indiana, and that's the yellow line, and the red line is the national line, overtook those of the United States in 2006. And in 2014, Indiana ranked 16th nationally for drug overdose fatalities. While overdose deaths due to prescription drugs have leveled off in many states, the overdose deaths in Indiana attributed to these drugs continues to rise. And as you can see, this is an age distribution for drug poisoning deaths in Indiana in 2014, and this is data that's hot off the press, just published yesterday. Overdoses are responsible for a significant number of Hoosier lives lost in their prime parenting and productive years. But even teenagers and the elderly are affected by this epidemic. In 2012, this is data from 2012, and this infographic was put together by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And you can see Indiana in the where the red arrow is. Indiana prescribers were the ninth highest opioid prescribers in the nation, prescribing 109 painkiller prescriptions for every 100 people in the state, more than twice the number of Hawaii. Nationally, primary care providers are the primary source of these prescriptions. And this is an infographic from the 2011 Youth Risk Behavior Survey that was done in high schools throughout the state of Indiana. And the results of that survey showed that one out of five of our high school students had ever taken a controlled substance for non-medical reasons without a prescription. And that's not surprising, really, given the number, the amount of these drugs that are just kind of hanging out in medicine cabinets at home due to large numbers of pills prescribed for procedures that may only require a couple of days of pain medication like wisdom tooth extraction or other outpatient surgeries. The other thing, teens typically view these medications as safe because they are prescribed. So prescriptions that come from a doctor really should help you and not be harmful. And in fact, 60 to 70% of teens say that they get their drugs from their parents' medicine cabinet. In 2015, and this is just data from the first 5 months of 2015, but Indiana was leading the nation in the number of pharmacy robberies. Twice as many robberies during the first half of the year as California, and five times more robberies than the entire state of Texas. And we led the nation in 2014 as well. And as cheap heroin became available, individuals actually would move away from prescription drugs, which tended to cost more on the streets and became more difficult to find when they were reformulated. And so they were more difficult to abuse. The Mexican cartels moved in and began providing a very effective system of delivery, sort of like you call the Donatos and order pizza and they bring it right to your door. Home delivery of inexpensive black tar heroin, pure. This was anonymous, and it was affordable. And many of our communities now are witness, actually, to the disease and death and destruction caused by this epidemic of heroin abuse. And the numbers of overdose deaths where heroin was listed as a contributing cause continues to rise in Indiana. And this is a graph that just shows the increases over time, and you can see the area underneath that curve in the back is getting larger and larger. This is these are two maps comparing hepatitis C virus infection incidence between 2006 and 2012. Hepatitis C, if you will, is sort of the canary in the coal mine. It the main method of spreading hepatitis B is injection drug use. And as you can see, in 2006, Indiana didn't report hepatitis C infections. In 2012, we start to see those counties filling in. This really was a foreshadowing of what we were to see in Scott County during our HIV outbreak. So I'm going to move over here so I can read this. You can read it as well, but just an overview. In late 2014, we had three new diagnoses of HIV infection in Austin, Indiana. We learned that two had a common needle-sharing partner, and we began contract tracing, and quickly the number of partners identified increased, and eight more infections by January 23rd. Only five infections had been diagnosed in the entire Scott County between 2004 and 2013. So already we had 11 infections, and it was clear that we were seeing something that was really abnormal. And as of February 4th of this year, we now have 189 individuals who have been diagnosed with HIV. And all are linked, not all necessarily live in, but all are linked, their drug injection use is linked to Austin, Indiana. And some studies that were done by the CDC, genetic studies, found actually just a single strain of HIV. And so they were able to identify that these individuals were all part of linked networks. Over 90%, actually it's about 91% co-infected with hepatitis C. And the source of that infection was injection drug use of the prescription drug, Opana ER, oxymorphone, and it mainly the brand name, and we actually have asked folks to identify the pills, the 30 milligram, 40 milligram Opana ER formulation, which interestingly was reformulated. Let's see. And there's a picture of it. Yeah, OxyContin was reformulated in 2010. That was the drug of choice to that point. When it became reformulated, it was really, you couldn't crush it, you couldn't sniff it, you couldn't dissolve it and inject it. And so folks migrated to Opana, which was not tamper resistant at all at that time. In 2012, the extended release formula of Opana was made tamper-resistant. They didn't get that indication from the FDA, but they put a plastic coating around it to try to reduce the diversion. And unfortunately, you couldn't crush it and sniff it anymore, but you were able to extract the drug by cooking it down with water and injecting it. So we saw a lot of folks actually migrate to injection drug use because they couldn't use it any other way. The cost is about $160 per 40 milligram tablet. Those tablets are often divided, shared amongst more than four individuals because of the price. There are multiple injection episodes, injections with each injection episode to get every last bit of drug out of the filters that have to be used to prevent the plastic coating that's been dissolved from clogging the needle or from getting injected, no clean needles at the time this outbreak occurred. So a lot of reasons why HIV had the opportunity to spread so quickly in this community. And actually, Opana ER has a higher morphine equivalent dose, milligram per milligram, than heroin and morphine. It's interesting when you talk to folks in the community, they'll tell you, no, I've never used heroin. I don't want to use heroin. Heroin scares me. They don't know how pure it is, what it might be laced with. Opana is the drug of choice, and there's very little heroin use in this community. So this is just a picture of an area in Austin. There's about a half square mile area in Austin where we were able to geomap early on in the outbreak the HIV, folks who were infected with HIV, and there were 89 HIV-positive individuals living in this one-half-square-mile area. And so I just put this up here to show that when you calculate an incidence rate based on the population, 34 cases per 1,000 people puts this on par, in fact, ahead of many sub-Saharan African countries where we tend to think of HIV being a huge problem in those countries. So responding to the heroin epidemic, and I've crossed it, I don't know if you can see opioid, because this is a new sort of HHS initiative. But I really think that we need to respond to the opioid epidemic and not just focus on heroin, at least from the Indiana perspective. And, in fact, preventing people from starting heroin really does mean preventing people from starting to misuse opioids that are prescribed in doctor's offices and then purchased illicitly off the streets. Importantly, and this is where perhaps Indiana falls a little bit short, is, and I think that with the governor's task force, we are trying to make strides in this area to ensure access to medication-assisted treatment. There is effective treatment for opioid addiction. There are multiple, but there are 12-step programs that are less effective. There's medication, opioid-related therapies like Suboxone and Methadone. And then there's naltrexone, which is an opioid antagonist. And the last three, the Suboxone, Methadone, and naltrexone, actually are as effective as anything, more effective than abstinence-based therapies for treating opioid addiction. And a lot of that has to do with brain chemistry and the reasons people do develop addiction. Really need to focus on getting folks into effective treatment and then understand that treatment is not just a one-shot deal, that you can relapse. In fact, it's the very nature of the disease. And understanding that relapse is to be expected is normal. And rather than saying, oh, gosh, you know, you failed, you're done, you wouldn't do that with a diabetic patient. So why do we think that that's okay with somebody who suffers from opioid addiction, which is now classified as a chronic disease? That is an area, I think, that really deserves attention. And then overdose reversal. And again, any opioid is reversed by the drug naloxone. Not just heroin. So expanding the use of naloxone, and Indiana has done a great job with this, passing legislation, getting it into the hands of first responders, and then also to families and family members and friends. We can do better. All right. So the Indiana Prescription Drug Abuse Prevention Task Force was created in 2012. Under the Office of the Attorney General, Greg Zeller, and used a framework recommended by the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. And this particular document was compiled by the Education Committee of that task force. And this is a best practice toolkit for prescribers, actually. I think Scott, you're going to go into more detail about best practices there, so I won't. But this toolkit, I'll just let you know, has drawn national attention. The Medical Board of North Carolina has adopted much of our task force. The CDC has seen, or much of the toolkit the CDC has used this. I got calls from New Mexico about this. So this is something that we're very proud of. INSPECT, that's our prescription drug monitoring program here in Indiana. We've been tracking opioid prescribing data. And we were pretty excited to see the decreases after we, through the Attorney General's Task Force in 2012 and 2013, began educating providers. In 2013, we published emergency rules for prescribing opioids to treat chronic pain. Then we saw an uptick. That's just recent data for 2015. There are a lot of reasons that this could be a legitimate uptick. Tramadol was rescheduled, so this could include tramadol that physicians are prescribing in lieu of prescribing stronger opioids. This could reflect treatment rates with Suboxone. Suboxone contains an opioid. So this could also reflect more individuals having insurance and seeking medical care. So we really need to understand better why we're seeing this uptick. And if our rules are not working, if we need to really be providing more education to providers around this, and I think all those things are probably true, but we do need to understand more about this. So what is drug addiction? Addiction is a chronic relapsing brain disease. So it's not a character flaw, it's not a moral weakness, it is classified as a disease. It's characterized by compulsive drug seeking and use despite the harmful consequences. And I can tell you firsthand from the work I've done in Scott County that individuals, these are parents, they've had jobs. Some of them have, graduated from high school or received GEDs. They have lost everything. They have lost their children. They have lost their houses. They have lost their jobs. Their existence is hustling from morning to night in order to get money to buy the drug so they don't get sick. It's not the way they want to live. It's what their brains are telling them. It's overriding the sort of normal functional capacity, the normal rational functioning of your brain. And this is because there are physiologic changes in your brain when you use opioids and when you continue to use them. And these brain changes can be long-lasting and lead to harmful behaviors. So, like many states, Indiana's capacity to treat its increasing population of people who inject drugs is inadequate. And you can see, do I have an arrow there? Yeah, there's Indiana. So this is the rate of past year opioid abuse or dependence, and this is the medication-assisted treatment capacity, and here is Indiana. So a very high rate of past year abuse or dependence with a gap in treatment capacity for effective treatments using medication. And I'm happy to say that the Governor's Task Force, actually, and you're probably all aware of this, recently announced an initiative with community hospitals to build a treatment facility there. And so that's very, very good news. And I'll also say that the Attorney General's Task Force actually has a program that allows for tuition reimbursement for professionals who do addiction treatment in their practices. So these are all great strides. There's still a lot of resistance for medication-assisted treatment here in the state of Indiana. Folks will say, you know what, no, not in my backyard. I don't want a Suboxone provider in my backyard. Or, you know, it's Suboxone, that gets diverted. And it does get diverted. But when we talk to folks in Scott County, that's not their drug of choice. They'll use it if they're trying to stop using other drugs, but they can't get it from a provider, so they'll buy it off the street. Or they'll use it if they can't get their other drug because it keeps them from feeling sick. So it's not their drug of choice, but there's supply and demand pressure. I don't want to use, but there's not a provider who will help me with this. So we have some work to do there. Now, I have just a minute left. These are maps, again, just released data. These are drug poisoning deaths. Red is bad. Orange is bad. Green is less than zero. These are deaths. They're not rates. And that's 2013. And you can see there's more orange on the 2014 than 2013. But it really stands out when you're looking at the rates. So that's 2013 drug poisoning death rates. And we'll go back to 2014, and you can see that our drug poisoning deaths continue to increase. And the same thing with non-fatal emergency room visits. So that's 2014. That's the number of visits. And these are rates of visits. So these are the folks who, get naloxone in the field and get transported to the hospital. And speaking of naloxone, This is called optin.in.gov. It's a website where lay providers can go to register to become entities to dispense naloxone to other lay providers. So the legislation was passed last year allowing us to do this. And we now have, I believe, 15 registered entities with over 500 distribution sites. And some of our pharmacies have stepped up, CVS and Walgreens, and I understand Kroger's is coming online. And that's great because even the rural communities have, you know, a pharmacy where people can get this. But there are also individuals who are just committed. Many of them have loved ones who have died from overdoses, and they're committed to preventing that from happening to others. Naloxone is safe. It's easy to use. It's just a nasal spray. And this is syringe access programs, and these are counties that are somewhere in process or have already developed syringe exchange programs. So that's just to show you how that's moving forward. And obviously, this does not have any impact on drug use, but what this does is it really allows people who are going to inject drugs to do it in a manner which is going to hopefully prevent the infection with HIV or hepatitis C or hepatitis B. So moving forward, we need to continue to focus on evidence-based opioid prescribing for acute and chronic pain. We need age-appropriate HIV and substance abuse prevention education, and we need to begin in elementary school. I've talked with many parents who said, you know, I just go in my bedroom and do it. I don't want my kids to see that I'm doing this. Unfortunately, you know, kids are smarter than we often give them credit for being. We need to improve access to meaningful data, including inspect data, the EMS registry system, and coroner's reports, so we truly understand what's going on across the state. And Inspect has been great working with us and sharing their data with us. We need increased access to treatment for substance use disorder. We need to increase access also for hepatitis C and HIV treatment. And I was going to say a little bit about Project Echo, which is a force multiplier option for primary care docs. It's experts who, via web-based, I don't want to call it telemedicine because it isn't really. It's more tele-information sharing. Will staff cases, will help providers treat patients and treat them at very high standards. And, in fact, this has a lot of evidence behind it, and it's been used in New Mexico for about 10 years with actual outcomes, health outcomes in the field equivalent to or even better than health outcomes at the large university setting, which is leading this program. So it's a way to equip our primary care providers with the information they need to treat patients for hepatitis C, for HIV, but also for substance use disorder to help give them that comfort level. And we need to decrease the stigma of addiction in HIV because many people feel that even sometimes just the language we use, clean versus dirty, calling people addicts, is saying to them subliminally, you're worthless. You know, you're low life. We don't want to take care of you. And so we need to embrace and urge people to get into care. Naloxone distribution programs, syringe exchange programs, these are all touch points that allow us to show people that we do value them as human beings and we want to help take care of them and their access to care points. Continue access to naloxone, increase testing for HIV and hep C, especially in high-risk communities. We can't wait for people to walk through a brick-and-mortar facility. We need to get the testing out there into the field. And then long-term solutions, obviously, for public health infrastructure and to improve socioeconomic disparities. So I'm already over. I knew I would be. I'm so sorry. But now I'm going to introduce Matt Neff and invite him to come up to the podium. Matt joined AIT Laboratories in 2013 after serving as president and CEO of CHV Capital Incorporated. I have no idea what that is. Okay. As an attorney by trade, Matt served in the first Bush administration and worked alongside former President Dan Quayle on Indiana's own. And I very much appreciated Matt and also Scott's help, their outreach to me during the HIV outbreak in Scott County to see how we could partner together. So please join me in welcoming Matt.
Thank you. Well, good morning. It's good to see many of you again. I don't get out of the lab very often the last couple of years, so good to reconnect with many of you. Let me ask you a question just to start. A show of hands, please. How many of you know somebody who has been, whose lives have been impacted by or terminated by opioid or heroin abuse? Look around you. That's a lot of people. This is scary, scary stuff. And we are talking today about ways to get ahead of it. As many of you know, I'm a reformed lawyer, and lawyers will tell you that one of the most immutable laws is the law of unintended consequences. And the unintended consequence here was that, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10 years ago, the medical community decided we were not being aggressive enough in treating pain. And pain is a very real thing. And if you have a loved one who's suffering, you want them to have painkillers. And in fact, hospitals, their performance is now scored, among other things, by the way that they manage patient pain. But the unintended consequence is that this is very addictive, and that the use of opioids, if not very closely controlled, any of us receiving it could have a switch go off and become addicted. So it is something that has to be very closely managed, or as Dr. Duvey has wonderfully illustrated, the ramifications are catastrophic for society. This, ironically, is not an urban problem in the United States. This is a central U.S. rural and small community problem. I grew up in a small town. These towns are being hollowed out by these problems. And how does it get started? The vast majority of them are started with well-meaning doctors who are trying to help patients. And the patient takes the prescription, goes off for long periods of time, may not revisit the doctor for a while, and that switch goes off. And that's how it starts. I don't have any statistics to back up this opinion, but I would bet any of you here a lunch that the largest prescriber of opioids in the United States today is the U.S. Veterans Administration. Think of the irony here. You have the federal government with a drug enforcement agency going in and raiding Veterans Administration offices because they believe that they are overprescribing. And we all know the capacity constraints on the VA as a result of war. And there are a lot of opioids prescribed, and I would submit to you they are not closely managed. But also think about high school athletes that you know that tear an ACL. They hurt their shoulder. They're playing football. They're running track. And they suffer an injury, and they start taking painkillers. And that's where it can start as well. So this is not any one socioeconomic segment. This is all of us. This is something we all have to get ahead of. So with that by way of introduction, we're lucky to have several expert panelists that are going to talk about this today. And I want to invite them to come up and join Dr. Duvey and me up here. The first is Kim Sharp. Kim is she's a registered nurse. She's the director of pain management for community health systems here in Indianapolis. She has been on the task forces that Dr. Duvey mentioned that are trying to come up with solutions and ways to manage the opioid problem. And then Scott Leneve. Scott is vice president of healthcare systems at AIT Labs. AIT is really the American Institute of Toxicology here in Indianapolis. And Scott and I have been working on a program and a product that we think is relevant to addressing this concern. So I'm going to ask each of these two panelists to make some brief remarks, and then we're going to go into kind of a Q&A, and we'll open it up for questions at the end. So, Scott?
Sure, thank you. And I want to pull up one slide, just one slide, that I'll talk off of for just a few minutes. And I want to begin by saying that Dr. DeVee did a great job of explaining the epidemic here in the state. And this is a national epidemic. It affects the whole country. The CDC has named it an epidemic. And as Matt just mentioned, it's not evenly spread throughout the United States. So every state doesn't have an equal portion. It is centered in Indiana, Ohio, West Virginia, Tennessee, Kentucky, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina. So sort of a Midwest to Southeast is where this problem really manifests itself. And, you know, the reaction from the state's most hardest hit has been mixed. There's only about 20-some states that have actually put rules in place. But before I talk about the product, GuideMed, I want to set the stage for what those rules are. And here in Indiana, we're fortunate. We have really good rules that were put in place. They're actually part of the law in this state. So whether the state made a law or just had recommendations, whether it was, you know, a medical licensing board requirement, all of the states that have made laws have one common theme. They aim the law at the prescriber. So they're not looking at the pharmacies. They're not looking at the patients. They're not looking at the payers. The prescription drug problem starts with somebody writing a prescription. And so the rules point at the prescriber. And in general, all of these state laws, particularly here in Indiana, ask for five things to be done. The first of those is a risk assessment. They ask the physician to perform an assessment on every patient of the risk of misuse before they prescribe. That makes sense, so that you know if this person is a high-risk patient or a low-risk patient before you write the prescription. The second thing they ask is for a controlled substance agreement to be put in place with the patient. Now, this agreement is literally like a contract. It's something that says, I'm going to write these prescriptions for you, but you have to agree to these conditions. Those conditions could be that you have to present yourself if I call. You have to submit to urine drug testing. We're going to, you can't go get this drug from any other doctor. You may have to go to the same pharmacy to pick it up. So I'm going to write the prescription, but you have to agree to some conditions. The next three items that the states require are all around monitoring. The first of those is to check the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, PDMP, database. In Indiana, we call it INSPECT. In Ohio, it's ORS. In Kentucky, it's CASPER. But these PDMPs are a database maintained when you go to the pharmacy and get one of these opioids or narcotic. It gets logged into the system so that doctors can check to see what other prescriptions any patient has received. And so first they say, check the PDMP. Second, they ask for a toxicology test. That's where you look at usually a urine specimen to see what drugs the patient has taken. And third is a pill count. This is it's a slang term for the process of sitting down with a patient and going through their medicines to make sure you know exactly what they have on hand. So think about this, sort of the logic, the beauty of it. It's you make a risk assessment, you see who's at risk, you put in place an agreement with the patient, and then you check to see what they picked up at the pharmacy, what they took, and what they have left. And if you just did those three things, look to see what they picked up, what they took, and what they have left, you would be comprehensively monitoring the patient for any misuse. You would see if they're getting drugs they shouldn't. You'd see if they took drugs they shouldn't or didn't take the drugs they should. And you'd see what they had on hand. So the rules make sense. And where the rules have been implemented, they work. The problem is implementing these rules is not easy. There are a lot of challenges to it. And I have to say that well-intentioned physicians have difficulty doing these things. This requires labor. It requires time. It's not easy to do. So I listed some of the challenges on the slides, like consistency, probably resourcing. There's no reimbursement for this activity, but it takes effort. I listed the patient-provider relationship is probably the most vocal thing that we hear all the time is physicians say, this isn't what I went to school to do. You know, I don't want to be the policeman here. I have a trusting relationship with my patient. We have to have that in the exam room. And it's, you know, it's mutually exclusive to say, trust me, and then turn around and say, let me count your pills. So this is a challenge, this relationship. And people go into medicine to take care of patients, you know, to believe in them and to trust them. And so this, it's a balancing act. And then last, I listed data management. We're now accumulating all of this information. Where does it go? Like, who's looking at it? So you've got pill counts and PDMP checks and toxicology results. Somebody has to store that. Somebody has to say, hey, is the controlled substance agreement up to date or not? And that makes it a real challenge. So all of that is a backdrop to talking about the actual product that we came up with when we recognized these challenges. But first, I wanted to mention three tenets. And the first of those is very simply, in order to prevent something, you have to watch for it. So you have to monitor in order to prevent. The second one is that opioids aren't the problem. Poor monitoring of patients on opioids is the problem. So 100 million Americans are afflicted with chronic pain. That's more people than diabetes, cancer, or cardiovascular disease combined. 100 million Americans. So we can't just say, well, let's stop writing prescriptions. Somebody has to take care of those people and restore function, get them back to health. And the third tenet up there is that providers need help doing this. So you've got sort of these three tenets in the background that says you've got to monitor in order to prevent. Opioids aren't the problem. Not monitoring is the problem. But we need to help providers. So we came up with a program. It's called GuideMed. And there's information out in the front lobby about it if anyone's interested. But very simply, we took the idea of putting specially trained nurses on site to actually perform the monitoring for the physicians. They're armed with an application that allows them to load all of the data into one central database. They can alert providers to any aberrant findings, and it pretty much just makes it easy for them to monitor.
Thank you, Scott. Kim, you are uniquely situated at the intersection of being involved in policy development, but also the day-to-day clinical application of these rules. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Thanks, Matt. As I said, I'm the director for pain management at Community Health Networks. My responsibility is I orchestrate throughout a very large network all of the efforts that we have been talking about here today and trying to keep how we are going to address this problem and look at this problem within our large, highly metrics network. So look at this. We know that there's a problem. No one can deny that. We've set the stage here very well. So we look at how can we approach this. And we do have one end of our spectrum is our treatment approach that Dr. Duvey kind of pointed out and spoke about our collaboration with through the government and or through the governor's task force and building a treatment center, and as that's coming, we're looking at a lot of things on that treatment end, but what we're really doing a lot of work in also is what I call the preventative end, and that's other things that Scott has brought in and shared with you, and so our approach on that end is first we have worked on changing a culture, laying groundwork to change a culture to decrease stigma for not only addiction, but for patients with chronic pain, because they're now automatically roped into, you have an addiction problem if you're even on one of these medications. And so changing, just down to the wording that we use in our facilities, we don't look at people as drug seekers.
We look at them for seeking help, and that help looks different to every person that comes through the door. So very much culture changing of our clinicians, our providers, everyone that's touching the patient, and also helping to change the culture in those coming to us and what their expectations are when they get to us, and trying to get the message out everywhere that managing pain does not automatically equal an opioid or prescription medication. So a lot of culture change in there. Also doing a lot of education. Providers of all disciplines will tell you, I did not learn about this in my training. So working, our efforts are bringing as much and as many modalities and forms as we can, educations to our clinicians. And I'm not just talking about our prescribers. I'm talking about our physical therapists, because they need to know how to manage pain better. Obviously, everyone coming to them usually has an issue. Our pharmacists, our nurses, everyone across the board. And that's dealing with pain, whether it's acute in our hospitals, or that is dealing with pain in our ambulatory settings, where it tends to become more of a chronic disease. We're educating on the chronic disease model of management. So pain and the things that we know and we've learned about managing diabetes and other chronic conditions applies to folks with chronic pain as well. So putting those in place. Putting structure in with team-based care. This is something that if you work in a hospital, or I came out, I've been doing this for over 30 years, and I started out in an acute care setting. And when we took care of patients in the critical care units and trauma units I worked in, we worked as a team. We had a pharmacist on board. We had the physician. We had the nurse. We had the respiratory therapist. And so we're taking that same concept out into our primary care practices, out into our ambulatory settings, and putting that same support structure to our providers that we've always had on the acute care side. So we have 16 hubs throughout our network that are located right in our primary care offices, our large pavilions, that consist of a pharmacist, a behavioral health expert, a licensed social worker, a nurse navigator, because as a nurse, I'm going to tell you, we're the glue. We keep the glue and we keep things moving between all of that for the patient. So we have those teams that are there, and our providers are beginning to feel like they're not in this alone, that as a network, they're supported and they are getting resources to help them help their patients. It also allows those long conversations that have to take place, because this kind of stuff doesn't happen in a 15-minute office visit. But it does and can happen when you sit with the behavioral health expert and they can have 30 minutes or an hour with you. And the pharmacist who can not just count your pills maybe, but really go through your medications and talk to you in length about side effects and the issues and the risk of being on some of these medications. So we work in conjunction as a team then. And then lastly, we've built a lot of infrastructure, or trying to build a lot of infrastructure in how we, in helping to manage these patients. And one of the things that we did was bring the AIT GuideMed program on board. We were the first primary care pilot site for them, definitely for in the state. And I challenged them. I challenged their product to the nth degree and put them into a family practice setting with also an internal medicine of 16 physicians. They were located on two different floors in three different office suites. And in 90 days, we had 90 days or 120 days, we had taken 780-some patients and had moved them into where all of this risk had been assessed. We had medication agreements in place. We in the appropriateness of urine drug screening, we had done that. We had given a package to our providers of data on specific to their patients, so that when they saw them and they went in to have that next visit with that patient, they had something from which to make a better medical decision on how they were going to move forward with the care of the patient. We took that off the lap of the provider feeling responsible for checking the boxes, collecting the data, and allowing them to look at the data that was there and use them at the top of their scope in making the medical decision that goes along with that data. Happy docs in that area, and they threaten me every time I come through there. If you ever take this away, I'm on their good side right now. So we are continuing to roll that out throughout our network now, and for 2016, we are rolling that throughout from Howard County down to Johnson County, from where we're at, and it's not inexpensive. There's a cost to this, but we don't get reimbursed for all of this. But what it does is provide better patient care in the end. It decreases the risk to those lives that we do touch, and it helps our physicians stay compliant with the law, and hopefully the DA is not in their office then. So it's kind of a win-win on everybody's part. And we're looking at different models where we put throughout our organization. Some models, what we have is a nurse right on site. Some areas are rural, and our Anderson and Madison County area, our practices are spread out, and they don't have a high volume of prescribing out of their practice, but they have some. So we may be looking at some kind of central location there where their patients can go and get this monitoring done, reports get back to the physician, just as you would go to the lab to, have your blood work drawn before your next office visit. It's a very similar concept. Looking at also things in optimizing our electronic medical record and how can we use it to help clinical decision making and drive the clinical decisions that we do and use those flags. So I'm probably about out of time too, but that's in a very quick nutshell some of the work that we're doing, boots on the ground, trying to make a difference.
Good. Thank you, Kim. Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to ask the panelists a couple of questions, and then we'll open it up for questions from the floor. Dr. Duvey, the state has spent a lot of time and money developing its prescription drug monitoring database, which is called INSPECT. From your perspective, how well is that working? Does it detect aberrancies? And from a clinical user's viewpoint, is it a valuable resource that can be relied on?
So INSPECT is a model prescription drug monitoring program, actually led the nation in terms of functionality and cross-border sharing of data. So the first program to share with neighboring states. And now I believe, I've lost count, but we share with 20, 25 states, and every day that number goes up. So I love INSPECT. And I think the providers who actually use INSPECT really appreciate the value it brings. The problem is, well, let me just step back. There was an INSPECT EHR, Electronic Health Record Integration pilot project that was done at the then Wishard Hospital Emergency Department. And what was found was that physicians with that integration where inspected data, the data on prescriptions that had been dispensed to their patient, was available within the workflow, within the context of the electronic health record, facilitated decision-making both to prescribe or not to prescribe. So physicians felt more comfortable with folks who were coming in saying, I'm in pain, I need a prescription. They'd have the data showing that patient wasn't getting multiple prescriptions from multiple providers and pharmacies. And they'd say, okay, you know what? Yeah, we feel comfortable with this. And the flip side was true also. If there were folks who were accessing multiple providers, getting drugs from multiple providers and multiple pharmacies, that information became available to them, and they were very comfortable saying, I'm sorry, I can't fill this prescription for you. You just got a prescription filled 3 days ago for 60 Lortab or whatever. So the physicians were really, really happy with that model. The pilot was so successful that the model was actually expanded to other emergency departments within the central Indiana area. I heard anecdotally that physicians would say, you know what, you can't take this away. If you take it away, we will be so lost and put a lot of pressure on administration to maintain that program. I believe there were some perhaps some legal questions that were being addressed, and so I think the integration was turned off briefly, and we're hoping to get that up and running again. I don't exactly understand. That's, you know, I'm not a reform lawyer, so I don't really understand what those issues were. But I know that the program was successful, and we're really looking forward to, and have spoken a lot with the folks in the INSPECT program, and actually have written in integration as one of our grant budget items for a grant that we hope will get funded this year, hopefully, fingers crossed. So we would really like to move forward with that. And the good news is that the VA is written in as part of that also. So it's just, I think, going to revolutionize how our providers have access to this really valuable data.
Good. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Kim, I've heard providers from time to time threaten to stop writing opioid prescriptions entirely or decrease them dramatically because they're worried about the risk of hurting somebody, of the DEA coming through the door, or the legal exposure of complying with the bitter pill rules in Indiana, Medical Licensing Board Rule 6. How do you view this, and how does the medical community deal with the risk of liability and a lot of bad things on the one hand versus a patient who's truly in pain?
That's a loaded question. First of all, yeah, glad it's me, huh? First of all, let me say it's not a threat. They're not threatening to do this. We've seen this happen across our state. We've seen this happen, I'm going to say, within our own network, was an attempt to say, I'm just not going to do this anymore. And what happens is we have patients who are abandoned. Their care becomes abandoned, and then they begin to seek in other ways that we kind of talked about, Dr. G, we spoke about, if you can't get it from a provider, then you begin to look, you know, in other directions. So as a network, what we have done with our approach is the fact that this goes back to the culture change that I talk about. Everyone in our network is responsible for managing a patient's pain, whether it's emotional or it's physical or what it is. Not everyone is required to write an opioid prescription, but they must maintain their DEA license. They can't say, I just won't have a DEA license, and then you don't have to worry about it. And they have to use that and consider that down the road of a treatment plan if the patient comes to that. But we're really, again, going back to the education of educating our providers on what are better options, what are some things that they should be trying first for pain management, before they ever get there. And then when they do, when that comes to the table, if it comes to the table, then putting in the things like the GuideMed monitoring program to give them that structure has made them feel more comfortable in being able to go ahead and write, unless they feel they're less at risk. They feel there's at least a shared risk in this. And that, again, when they can make a better medical decision and feel a more appropriate medical decision and decide that, yeah, this is what is needed, at least in this point in time for this patient, then that structure is around them to support that, and that we're doing that.
Thank you. Scott, you mentioned the software that AIT developed, which we did in partnership with a local company called Key Labs. It seems like, you know, there's a natural human tendency to look at somebody as a static condition. But in fact, their conditions change over time. Their pain goes up and down. They have different emotional factors working on them at any point in time. Mm-hmm. Do you think, does the risk of becoming addicted fluctuate? And if you're a doctor, how do you manage changing circumstances with an individual patient?
Well, so first, let me just say I'm not a doctor, but I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express recently. To begin, the doctor has to look. So it all starts there. You have to look to see what's going on with the patient. And then from there, what the best practice seems to be today is all evidence-based, risk-adjusted monitoring. So if you identified a patient to be at low risk, but they show up with unprescribed opiates in their system, well, that's a sign that you probably need to upgrade their risk level and monitor more frequently. Likewise, if you identify someone as high risk, but they've gone, you know, a year, I don't know what the time frame is, but let's say they've gone a year without a single aberrant behavior, no problems on the PDMP, no tox problems, and pill counts are always perfect, then you might be able to monitor less frequently. So I think the standard of care, if you look at all the different state rules and prescribing guidelines and everything that's been written, even the CDC has published some draft guidelines. Johns Hopkins did a big study. Everyone talks about evidence-based, risk-adjusted monitoring so that you almost need automation to do that. You need a program that says, okay, if this happened, then this is what we do, and sort of guide that clinical decision-making. And to Kim's point, it isn't that this overrides a physician's judgment. It just supports them to say, here's more information. You might want to monitor this patient a little more closely, or this one over here seems to be doing fine. Maybe you can back off on the monitoring.
Thank you. Dr. Duvey, one of the things that we were surprised to learn in Scott County was the way that public health responsibility is allocated in Indiana. That is, what is the role of State Department of Health versus the County Health Department? Do you think that it's properly allocated, or when there are medical emergencies like we saw in Scott County, would it be appropriate for the state to have more authority rather than the way it is today where the county is really in charge?
Well, I mean, I think that's a sort of a politically charged question, and it's above my pay grade to really respond directly to that question. But I will say that, counties, public health occurs at the local level. And in Indiana, we have a system called home rule, where county health departments actually do and are responsible and are funded locally with some assistance from federal and state partners to provide care for the folks in their community. And I think that's a good model because, you know, sitting in Indianapolis, I really don't know from a day-to-day basis what's going on the ground in local communities. But the people who live there do. Mm-hmm. And I'll just call out Jackson County. I've done some work with Schneck Hospital. They are acutely aware of what the health needs and the public health needs are in their community. And they really are rising to that challenge. And I think when there's vested interest and ownership at the community level, then the chances that the solutions will be sustainable really increase. So I think that, you know, it's while we can provide technical assistance and support when needed, because during a big outbreak, like mumps on our college campuses, local systems can become overwhelmed. And I think that we saw that in Scott County, and so we're happy to step in and help out in those situations. But we couldn't do the work that we do without our local partners.
So. Very good. Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, let's open it up to the audience to see if there are any questions. Yes, sir.
Says they have to check that data, and we're hopeful that if we were able to reinstate the data flow, that checking that data through the health information exchange or data conveyed into their EHR would meet that requirement.
Well, so I can't comment on the legislation. I think that my understanding is that the State Medical Association is working to, you know, provide some input into monitoring, and I'm not sure where the monitoring component of that bill actually will fall out. But monitoring using Inspect is required actually in the chronic pain prescribing rule when opioids are used. That's in place today. So there already is a requirement for practitioners who are managing individuals on opioid therapy for chronic pain. That's to check annually. Some states require checking their prescription drug monitoring program every time an opioid is prescribed. And I know that there are many hospital systems here in Indiana that require their emergency department physicians to check when they're prescribing for acute pain also. And so that's sort of a more homegrown solution, and we'll be working with recommendations for prescribing for acute pain. That's one of the charges the State Department of Health has received from the governor. And it'll be a sort of a joint effort. It's at the governor's task force request, but we'll draw in the expertise from the Attorney General's task force to help us with those guidelines and practitioners, because we can't do this without people who are seeing patients on the ground. And we want these won't be rules, it won't be a law, they'll be best practice recommendations. So I don't know if that answered your question. Inspect is a really valuable tool. How often you check it, there are arguments both pro and con.
Keith?
The issue of patient abandonment came up in terms of the pain claims. And I think what I'm seeing for the first time from one end of the country to the other is physicians are making fear-based decisions rather than evidence-based decisions when it comes to prescribing. Indiana seems to have taken a really tough stand with the bitter pill legislation. At the last task force meeting, the Attorney General mentioned that 17 providers' licenses have been taken, 9 clinics closed. Unfortunately, I don't think anybody stopped to consider that as we're talking about expanding access to MAT, the very pool of providers who I'm going to draw from to create an MAT network is the same pool that's being pointed at and said, we're watching what you're doing, we're taking licenses when you're inappropriate. Is there any kind of initiative being started maybe to groom or to encourage providers to follow evidence-based and good practice? Because if you think the abandonment issue is bad, trying to get physicians or prescribers to work in MAT programs, when you tap on the stigma of addiction, it's tough. And I'm finding that here in Indiana, recruiting physicians who, since the DEAX is specific to physicians, and that's where the only way I can get folks for treatment is non-OTP or Vivitrol programs, what's the state doing to maybe enhance the pool of waivers?
So let me restate that question just because this is being recorded and I forgot to repeat John's question. Your question essentially can be boiled down to, we seem to have a shortage of practitioners who are expertise in MAT, medically assisted therapy, and what is the state doing to try to address that shortfall, because MAT is kind of the back end of trying to help the addict or the addiction problem and manage that. Is that for Kim, would you say? Would you like a clinical response? You want a policy response from Joan? More policy? Joan?
I think last year there was legislation passed to expand the number of medication-assisted treatment facilities. I think the cap was increased by 5. But there were some parameters placed around that to try to provide medication-assisted treatment within a more sort of medical therapeutic context. So rather than having freestanding methadone clinics that are for-profit, perhaps integrating those into community mental health centers or hospitals so that the support services, the counseling, wraparound services that individuals who suffer from substance use disorder might need in order to be successful in their recovery, So I believe that, and again, this is a little bit out of my realm, that the Department of Mental Health and Addiction is currently writing rules for the implementation of that. I don't know where those rules stand. And hopefully we'll start to see some emerging best practices here in the state of Indiana for expanding medication-assisted treatment based in facilities. But I think your question about the primary care physicians, and they do need to be physicians, prescribing Suboxone therapy or using naltrexone. So it's interesting. Naltrexone is an opioid antagonist. It's not even an opioid, but there's still there aren't a lot of providers who are willing to take on that additional charge of managing patients with substance use disorder. And I don't know whether it's due to the medications that they need to use, because if it were that, you would think that we would see folks using naltrexone, and we don't. There are some, but most providers aren't. Is it the stigma of treating folks with substance use disorder? I hear from providers, I just don't really want my practice to become known as the place where addicts come to get treatment. And so I feel like that may have something to do with it. And so then what that says to me is that we need to really provide ongoing education. And I think that that's been really the crux of the work on both task forces, trying to get the word out there to the public. And I know ISMA has had, the State Medical Association has had a great initiative encouraging providers to, here's how to treat pain responsibly. They've done multiple CME events. They published something about opioid prescribing in almost every newsletter to help their providers. So I think, did you say this, Scott? We don't receive training in medical school to treat chronic pain or to prescribe opioids. And in fact, contrary, we were told when I was in residency that if you're treating a patient with a chronic pain and use opioids, they can't get addicted. Don't worry about it. So, and that's exactly the opposite of now what we know to be true. But we weren't given a lot of medical guidance. Instead, the guidance we got came from the pharmaceutical industry. And I believe that a lot of docs in my generation, sort of that was the message they left residency with. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of the prescribing practices, we can't blame the entire problem on any one thing. I don't want to do that. It's a complex problem. I don't want to boil it down. But that may have something to do with it.
Kim, I want to ask you, because the community health is so strong in behavioral health, do you have a perspective on MAT?
We do. I mean, we're trying to build our MAT providers, and we're seeing some of the same struggle, and we have probably one of the strongest behavioral health systems in the city and the state, but we're still seeing the same struggle and the fear that was talked about, that you just don't, kind of trying to get them to take that step, which is where I go back to, we're trying to put this team-based approach into our, pavilion, so that those providers don't feel that they have to handle even MAT all alone, but they have a behavioral health expert with them, on location there, a pharmacist, and that team support to help them through that.
Good. Thank you. We have time for one more question. Did you want to make?
This one, the team-based approach is really the model that the ECHO project that I spoke about is trying to replicate. But in many rural areas, you don't have the availability of pharmacologists, of social workers, that nice team that Kim was talking about. So the ECHO model is trying to really electronically bring those providers to the primary care docs who work in rural areas. So I just wanted to add that.
So. Question over here.
We were, when you kind of looked at it as a whole and rolled it in, going prior to the pilot, we were about 30% compliant with getting all of those components of, the measurement done and everything on. At the end of the pilot, we were above 98% compliant with those 780 patients.
Yes.
Hi, this is for Dr. Dubik. One of the recommendations that you made
So, again, this is, you know, FSSA, it's a different division than where I work, but what I will say is we've had a lot of conversations with folks at FSSA, and they've been really, really helpful. So, for example, primary care docs actually are not authorized to prescribe treatment for hepatitis C. We were able to work with them to allow primary care docs to participate in an ECHO model for hepatitis C treatment so that they're not consulting with an infectious disease doc locally, but perhaps, again, using telehealth services. Can then be authorized through Medicaid and the Medicaid managed care organizations to prescribe medications to treat their patients. So I think that's a really positive step forward for our primary care docs who are really the front lines in many of our rural communities. In Scott County, there isn't an infectious disease doc. There isn't a hepatologist. So treating co-infected patients, which there are no restrictions. If you have HIV, you are covered for treatment under hepatitis C under Indiana Medicaid, but you didn't have the right kind of doc. So we've tweaked a few things, and we think we fixed that problem. It's expensive. Treatment for Hep C is expensive. Some Hep C infections will resolve on their own, so don't even need treatment. So trying to understand how best to use those resources effectively is, I think, something that nationally people are looking at and working on. And I think everyone is hoping that over time the cost of treatment will come down and we'll be able to afford to treat everyone who's infected with hepatitis C. But there are a lot. Hep C is so much easier to acquire than HIV. There are a lot of folks infected with Hep C across the state, across the country. So it may just be a matter of time.
So we may have time for one more quick question. Yes, sir.
I'll try and be quick. When HIV hit us in the 80s, a lot of communities built education systems. I'm going back to your slide where the education solutions are really the grassroots way that you can get at where a disease comes from and how you can prevent being affected by a disease process. This is so much more complicated. But one of the things that showed up was alternative channels of information distribution, like the education systems and churches and synagogues and temples got very involved with simple information that was given to them about the sources of HIV. Is there something that's akin to that that's coming along on the opioid side where you can give a minister or a priest or a trusted person in people's lives other than the experts who we as scientists are typically reaching for first, even something that's available over the internet to help educate people and to help educate the people who people go to? See what I'm trying to ask?
Yeah, good question. It has to do with alternative methods of communication of how to get at the opioid epidemic through not necessarily medical channels, but community and church and other organizations. Joan, do you want to comment on that?
I mean, I think that's a terrific idea. What we've seen in Scott County is the faith-based community has really rallied to support efforts to feed the individuals affected. I mean, literally dinners almost every night supplied to individuals in Austin who may not be able to afford food. They are holding recovery groups. They have been instrumental in this response, and I think that's a great idea.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'd like to turn it back to our friends from BioCrossroads. Thank you all for attending today, and I'm sure the panelists will be around if you have additional questions, and they'd be happy to talk to you. Lori?
Yes. Thank you so much for joining us today. While it's a not great situation right now, it's wonderful that we have such collaborative efforts going on between the healthcare and industry within our life sciences. So we love seeing that, and we're excited that you guys can really make an impact on what's going on. So thank you very much. And thank everyone for coming today. I just want to remind everybody about our next frameworks. It's going to be March 24th, And we're going to focus on, we're going to have the Daedalus Center for Injury and Injury Surveillance, which is a BioCrossroads initiative. They work very closely with the NCAA. They're going to come talk to us about their concussion prevention and treatment programs that they're doing with youth sports. So you guys have seen a lot of that recently with the concussion movie that came out and some of the other things that are going on in the wrestling community. And these guys are actually looking at it at the youth level, so to help prevent and determine different rules and perhaps uniform things that they can change and things like that to prevent it. So that should be another great session. And, again, we thank you for coming and have a good day.